This exposure was not entirely to the good. Nehru, for example, who became India's first prime minister after independence, was highly influenced by Fabian socialism through the teachings of Harold Laski. The result was that India had a mismanaged socialist economy for a generation. But my broader point is that the champions of Indian independence acquired the principles and the language and even the strategies of liberation from the civilization of their oppressors. This was true not just of India, but also of other Asian and African countries that broke free of the European yoke. My conclusion is that against their intentions, the colonialists brought things to India that have immeasurably enriched the lives of the descendants of colonialism. Colonialism was the transmission belt that brought to India the blessings of Western civilization. It was a harsh regime for those who lived under it, to be sure. My grandfather would have a hard time giving even one cheer for colonialism. As for me, I cannot manage three, but I am quite willing to grant two. So here it is, two cheers for colonialism. Maybe you will now see why I am not going to be sending an invoice for reparations to Tony Blair. Back to Muhammad Ali, I understand him to be making the same point. Slavery was a grave moral crime that inflicted incalculable harm to the slaves. But the slaves are dead, and the truth is that their descendants are better off as a result of slavery. Jesse Jackson is vastly better off because his ancestors were enslaved than he would have been if that had never happened. If not for slavery, Jackson and others like him would be living in Somalia or Ethiopia or Nigeria. The enormous improvement in their condition can be verified by simply asking them whether they would consider moving to one of those places. As the African-American writer Zora Neale Hurston bluntly put it, "Slavery is the price I have paid for civilization, and that is worth all that I have paid through my ancestors for it." I realize that in saying these things, I am opening the door for my critics and the incorrigible enemies of the West to say that I am justifying colonialism and slavery. This is the purest nonsense. What I am doing is pointing out an historical fact. Despite the corrupt and self-serving motives of their practitioners, the institutions of colonialism and slavery proved to be the mechanism that brought millions of non-white people into the orbit of Western freedom. It makes no sense to claim that the West grew rich and powerful by taking everybody else's stuff for a simple reason. There wasn't very much to take. Oh yes, there was, the retort often comes. The Europeans stole the raw material to build their civilization. They stole rubber from Malaya, and cocoa from West Africa, and tea from India. But as economic historian Peter Bauer points out, before British rule, there were no rubber trees in Malaya, nor cocoa trees in West Africa, nor tea in India. The British brought the rubber tree to Malaya from South America. They brought tea to India from China, and they taught the Africans to grow cocoa, a crop the native people had previously never heard of. None of this is to deny that when the colonialists could exploit native resources, they did. But this larceny cannot possibly account for the enormous gap in economic, political, and military power that opened up between the rest of the world and the West. What then is the real source of that power? I want to suggest that the reason the West became the dominant civilization in the modern era is because it invented three institutions: science, democracy, and capitalism. These institutions did not exist anywhere else in the world, nor did they exist in the West until the modern era. Admittedly, all three institutions are based on human impulses and aspirations that are universal. But these aspirations were given a unique expression in Western civilization, largely due to the influence of Athens and Jerusalem. Athens representing the principle of autonomous reason, and Jerusalem representing the revealed truths of Judaism and Christianity. First, let us consider science. It is based on a shared human trait, the desire to know. People in every culture have tried to learn about the world. Thus, the Chinese recorded the eclipses, the Mayans developed a calendar, the Hindus discovered the number zero, and so on. But science, which requires experiments and laboratories and induction and verification, what one scholar has termed the invention of invention, is a Western institution. This explains why the vast majority of major inventions in the past few hundred years have occurred in the West. If science were not a Western institution, there would be no way to account for this disproportion. Indeed, we would be forced to conclude that the rest of the world was incredibly stupid. Why did science develop in the West? This is a hugely complicated question and not one that I can fully answer. The best I can do is to suggest two lines of thought that led the West in this direction. To locate the first, one has to go back to the ancient Greek philosophers. The ancient Greeks invented philosophy, which was an attempt to learn the truth about the world through unassisted human reason. No other ancient society placed so much confidence in reason. Philosophy, as the Greeks understood it, included science. It was a study of nature and of human nature. Greek philosophy from the time of Socrates emphasized the latter, and thus made little headway in figuring out the mysteries of nature. But even so, the Greeks came up with the notion that the universe as a whole makes sense, that it operates in accordance with laws, that these laws are accessible in principle to human reason, and that they can be expressed in the language of mathematics. It is important to realize that there is no logical reason why these things should be true. The influential Muslim writer Al-Ghazali denies them. In The Incoherence of Philosophy, he argues that reason and logic are useless in apprehending the universe because Allah intervenes at every single moment to make things happen in the way that they do. This represents the Muslim version of the belief in an enchanted universe, governed by spirits, that is characteristic of many ancient peoples. To believe in the Greek notion of a reality that is not arbitrary, that obeys mathematical laws, a reality that is reasonable and susceptible to human understanding, is to have a certain kind of faith, a faith in reason. The Greeks did, and in subsequent centuries this faith was strengthened in the West by the Christian notion of a divine being who embodies reason and truth and who created the universe and man. Many of the great scientists of the West, among them Copernicus, Kepler, Boyle, and Newton, believed that their work demonstrated the hidden hand of God in the universe. Their science was inspired and fortified by their Christian faith. The faith is much weaker among scientists today. Probably very few practicing scientists see their work as confirming a divine presence. But all of them, even those who have never heard of the Greeks and who reject Christianity, nevertheless operate on the Greek and Christian assumption that reality is rational. Without this assumption, without this faith, science itself becomes impossible. A second notion that is crucial to the development of science is the idea of development itself, the idea of progress. Sociologist Robert Nisbet terms it one of the master ideas of the West. We see it, for instance, in the teenager who says to her mother, "Mom, how can you believe that? This is 2002. That cliché is freighted with philosophical significance. It presumes a higher consciousness for the present than existed in the past. The belief in progress is also evident in the widespread expectation that our knowledge and our economy will continue to grow, and that our children will know more and have a better life than we do. Europeans and Americans take these things for granted, but they are novel concepts that arose quite recently in the West. The idea of progress, like the idea of reason, is a doctrine that cannot be proved but must be taken on faith. The Greeks didn't have this faith. They believed that history moves in cycles. One may say that the Greeks believed in change, but not in progress. To the degree that the Greeks found a pattern in this change, it was largely one of degeneration. For many Greek thinkers, the Golden Age was in the past, and things had been going steadily downhill since then. Of course, the Greeks admitted that things could get better, but they believed that they could just as easily get worse. What governed human destiny was chance or fate. These notions of cyclical change and degeneration and fate were not unique to the Greeks. They were shared by the Hindus, the Muslims, the Buddhists, the Confucian Chinese, and by virtually everyone else in the world. The modern West is the only civilization to entertain the idea that there is a meaningful pattern in history, that this pattern is onward and upward, that knowledge is cumulative, and that its applications to human betterment are continuous and never-ending, that the future is certain to be better than the past. Utopia is, in this sense, a Western concept because it locates perfection in the future.